How do you do, ladies and gentlemen? This is Sidney Roger, and I have with me at the microphone Mrs. Decca Truhaft. What we want to talk about is the Mitfords, the Mitford family, and the autobiography of Jessica Mitford, which happens to be you, Decca Truhaft. I'm saying all this now in this sort of roundabout fashion in order to set the scene very carefully, that we're going to speak primarily about the autobiography of Jessica Mitford, who is Mrs. Decca Truhaft, who lives in Oakland, California. And the autobiography is being published under the title Daughters and Rebels by Houghton Mifflin Company, and I think it's to come out, it's supposed to be on the stands on June the 9th, is
that's
that right?
That's right, yes, June 9th.
And it is the American edition of a book which I have another copy of it here, the fourth printing already in England. It's, say this for me, Hans and Rebels?
That's right, Hans and Rebels.
Daughters and Rebels is the American version, Hans and Rebels is the English version, and Hans means honorables?
Well, it does in a way, although it really means hens. It's rather complicated. It's explained in the book.
Well,
and I think it's easier not to go into it because it is so complicated. The Americans naturally felt that the title Hans and Rebels would be incomprehensible.
What makes you honorable in England? You're honorable enough here, as far as I'm concerned, because I'm crazy about you, Decca. But why are you specifically, with a capital H, honorable when you get to England?
Well, you see, you're automatically an honorable if your father is a peer, as mine was.
Let's see.
That's how it happened.
That's how it happened. You have a remarkable scrapbook of book reviews, of reviews of the book, in this case, Hans and Rebels, and of course, as I say again, it's Daughters and Rebels here, from England. It seems most unusual to have books reviewed with such enormous spreads. Here is a spread from the Sunday Express of March 20th that takes up 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 columns with a great deal of artwork, with a picture of all the daughters. There is Nancy, the best-selling novelist, Deborah, now the Duchess of Devonshire, with Prime Minister Harold Macmillan, Unity, the girl that says here, I am a Jew hater. This is, Unity was the one who became very involved with Hitler. And another daughter, another sister, Diana, who is the wife of Sir Oswald Mosley. And then there is you. What a strange family, and no wonder that the Sunday Express says, so much happened to the Mitfords. Why is this book so exceptionally popular in England?
Well, I think that a good deal of the reason is because there's been a tremendous amount of publicity about my family from time to time through the years, and I think that is why they've played the book up so enormously in the papers. I like to think that some of the reviewers like the book for itself, too, but I believe that that's the reason why such enormous coverage was given.
I think it's a fascinating book in and of itself, but I read here by Robert Pittman from the Sunday Express. It says, look carefully at the five aristocratic children in that family photograph. Can you detect any hints of destiny in their pretty faces? And by the way, you all are very pretty there, and still are, may I add. Could you say which would turn communist, or which would become Hitler's favorite, or which would win fame as a writer, or which would go to prison? Apparently, this isn't just a story of a group of honorables. This was an unusual family. Why?
Well, we did have an extraordinary upbringing. When I look back on it and have discussed it with cousins and contemporaries, people who came from more or less the same kinds of people that we did, I do think that our upbringing was really beat everything for bizarreness and so forth. For example, none of us girls were allowed to go to school. My brother, of course, went. My mother taught us herself at home. She taught reading, which became very handy in later life, and it was really almost all we ever learned. She also taught a little history. She taught us that the Americans had been expelled from the British Empire for causing trouble, and other facts that stood us instead, you know. But reading was really the only thing we were taught.
Is it because, despite the fact that Nancy Mitford, your sister, is one of the best-selling writers, is this limiting of education to the girls because this is about all you really need to get along in life?
very much the idea, I think. It's an idea which stemmed from Victorian times, although I must say that when I was a girl, many were being sent to school. In fact, it was the law. But, of course, my parents disregarded that sort of thing.
Because they could, and they could well do it, because they probably ran the school, didn't they? Or they were the I remember in the book you mentioned the fact that your father not only chose the, what would you call him, the reverend?
The vicar.
The vicar of the local church, but told him precisely what sermons to give and how long his sermons should be and what songs could be sung and what shouldn't be sung. He didn't like any of that foreign kind of singing, isn't that right?
That's true, and furthermore, he used to time the poor chap with a stopwatch, and if he went over 10 minutes, my father would be shaking his head like mad.
I see your father, according to the English edition, which is published by whom? Was it Golantz?
Victor
Golantz. The English edition says that your father was a man of fierce and irrational opinions, terrifying rages, a law unto himself. In a different way was your mother, Lady Redsdale, who brought up her children after a method all her own. But didn't these people, both your father and mother, represent something that was common to all the peerage, or were they themselves an unusual group of people?
I think they were somewhat eccentric. My father, we had a magnificent library at home, a really wonderful library compiled by grandfather. But my father had only read one book in his life, White Fang by Jack London.
Oh, really?
He always said it was such a damn good book, he didn't see the point of reading any others. But, of course, we used to read, you know, whatever there was in the library, which was an enormous amount.
Your grandfather was a writer, wasn't he?
He was a writer of sorts. I don't know if he would qualify really as a writer. He wrote his own autobiography. I suppose I'm in the same boat. But
runs in the family, in other words.
Yes. But he was a literate sort of person, apparently. Of course, I don't remember him very well.
The Earl of Birkenhead in the Daily Telegraph of the 25th of March says, "This shameless but most diverting book proves once again how vital eccentric relatives are to the writer of family novels." That's kind of cute, but you know, and this is a kind of a charming thing altogether, at the same time, I would say that this isn't just a family novel in that sense, you know, that there are family soap operas, television, all that. I think it has a great deal more depth, because you did discuss the rise of a left wing among English youth that was quite significant in its time and showed itself quite courageously in Spain as a case in point.
Yes, that's true. When you've written a book yourself, it's very hard to evaluate to what extent it's a light or amusing book and to what extent it tries to do something further. The critics have said, many of them, that it was evocative of the 30s in a general sort of way, that is, in the way that you speak of, I think. In other words, describing the uprising of movements of young people around pacifism, anti-fascism, the Labour Party, and this kind of thing.
One other reason why I find your book very, very interesting to me, I would say this to you, Decca, that I find the book, your autobiography, more exciting to me around the latter chapters, the last four or five chapters from Spain onwards through the time you came to the United States and became aware of the nature of the New Deal, because this really brought back a whole, well, to me, an enormously poignant and emotional and meaningful period of my own life and period of the lives of many, many people whom I hope will read Daughters and Rebels. Let's talk just a little bit about that long-forgotten place known as Civil War Spain.
Well, this, of course, was before the Civil War part of my book is before we came to America.
Yes.
My first husband, Esmond Romilly, who I've tried to describe and show in the book, and who was subsequently killed in the Second World War, was a volunteer in the International Brigades, along with thousands and thousands from all countries. And it was to Spain that he and I ran away. And we lived there. We lived in Bilbao for about a month, a part of Spain that was not particularly touched by the war at that time, except by tremendous privations and enormous air raids, but the fighting wasn't going on while we were there.
And you were 19 and he was 18 at
That's
the time.
That's right, yes. And we went there with the intention of joining up with the, he rejoining and I joining the international brigades. However, fate had it otherwise because the British consul sort of got us out of there by a trick, in a way. The things that, living in a town like that, that was threatened with attack, as Bilbao was, waiting really in the shadow of the attack that was to come, was an extraordinary experience, something that, it was more like living in a story to me, because it was so absolutely unlike anything I'd ever experienced, and the people were so unlike anybody I'd ever met.
Now, this was the incident in which the Anthony Eden sent the destroyer to pick you up, wasn't it?
That's right, and the Labour Party asked questions in the House of Commons about that destroyer, how come they were being used for this kind of purpose. But
pick up a member of the aristocracy.
That's right.
It was
yes.
to pick you up primarily, or also your, Romilly.
Well, Romilly went along. It was really to pick me up and take me home, but instead of going home, we just went to France and stayed there.
And he was a nephew, was he, of Winston Churchill's?
Yes, yes.
And then the Labour Party wanted to know why all this money. You know, this kind of reminds one of the time that great myth, that great rumor went the rounds that Franklin D. Roosevelt sent a destroyer somewhere to pick up a dog named Falla.
Oh, of course.
You remember
I remember
that.
In fact, that happened after the thing with us, and I think at the time I sort of noticed the parallel.
Parallel isn't entirely the same, of course, but that was a charming little dog, as I remember.
Yes.
Right. Then you came to the United States, and of course your adventures in the United States are absolutely hilarious. If you can imagine these two young people then, about 20, 21.
That's right.
Well, the civil war in Spain was well behind you then, wasn't it? The tragedy of the fall of Madrid and the end of the war was pretty much depressing everybody. You also, partly because of your background and interest and anti-fascist proclivities and the like, you also found a great deal to be excited in the New Deal. And may I add that to those of you who are too young to remember, perhaps in some other program I will discuss the meaning of the New Deal. It was a tremendous American institution that moved a great many of us into the feeling that something great had happened in America, and perhaps nothing quite like it has ever happened since. And yet I have a feeling, as Alexander Micheljohn happened to say to me just the other day in front of the City Hall, the day after what the college kids call the City Hall swim, he said that he has a feeling that the 60s are going to be an awfully good decade, and that the youth are going to speak up against a lot of bad things. But today's youth might speak of the New Deal the way my 14-year-old son often says to me, in the olden days when you were my age, did you ride a horse and buggy? But the New Deal was a very exciting thing to you, wasn't it?
I think the thing that made it so exciting, in a way, was to see an enormous number of young, enthusiastic people, some of them very little older than we were, and we were only 20 and 21 at the time, really feeling that they were going somewhere with a program. I mean, this was the thing that was exciting about it. And tremendously earnest and hardworking people from all over the country who were in Washington in those days in the various agencies of the New Deal, working their heads off for the betterment of the poor farmers, for the TVA, for the 1,001 projects that went to make up that administration. And it was an awfully exciting thing, and especially coming from England, where the idea of a government, you know, a civil servant, denotes a sort of a terrible, dried-up old thing in a black suit, you know. I mean, you couldn't imagine the extraordinary impression that this made on us.
Well, did you, coming from England, have the feeling, as so many people do in other parts of the world, that America was a very rich and stable land? And were you quite surprised to find what the Depression had wrought in this land of ours at the time you came here?
Well, you know, the awful thing is, I hate to tell you this, but we knew terribly little about America before we came. except what we had seen in the movies. In those days particularly, there was very little travel between the two countries, relatively. And I had a sort of vague impression of it from, sort of gangsters and tremendous amounts of making love and drinking and so on that you sort of got from the movies, and that was about all. And so it was really coming here, you see, that made the enormous impression on us.
And then you did find in the New Deal something that was, from your point of view, could I use the term revolutionary? Is that too strong?
Well, I think it is too strong in one way. One thing that amazed us, too, was that in spite of all the zeal and so forth in connection with the New Deal, that, you see, we've been accustomed, as all Europeans are, living in a country where there's a huge socialist party. The Labour Party, no matter what its policies, its platform is one of socialism. And one of the things that puzzled us terrifically was the lack of any such party in America.
Or the lack of any real distinction between the Democrats and Republicans. I want to say to you, Decca, that many of us are still just a little bit puzzled about
this. Exactly. You see, it goes on still today. The form of political parties here is terribly different. I wouldn't say we considered it revolutionary, because revolutionary would have denoted overthrowing the present system of capitalism.
Yes, but of course the New Deal was quite the contrary. It was putting a fairly firm foundation, or at least doing a fairly adequate bolstering job of the system, and doing it in such a way that more people got some of the benefits.
Exactly,
of the
that was the thing that impressed us so enormously. It was the absolute liberalism of the whole idea, and the wonderful way that it seemed to be working. That there is a new resurgence among the young people. I think you feel it and see it everywhere. Actually, I was pretty irritated with some of them about, 5 to 10 years ago. They seemed to be really a silent generation. And I do believe that whatever the cause, on every campus, not only around here, but what you read of what's going on in New York and so forth, really great things are happening among the young people. And I think that we will have a better, we are in for better times.